Blog Talk Radio.
Ninety minutes of talk. Three gentlemen get together once a week and experience that. I got a little challenge for you. You know, if you don't mind stepping up to it, maybe you will, maybe you won't. Here's what I want you to do. Get a couple of friends of yours and plan. You know, just give them a call. You know, say, you know what? Let's meet a certain date and a certain time. And we're going to talk for 90 minutes. And within that 90 minutes, you may say some things about yourself that's uncomfortable. You may think about yourself in an uncomfortable way. So plan the date, plan the time, and see if they show up. Because that's something myself, Mr. Charles, and Mr. DeMaurice has been doing for the past 4 to 5 years. We've been getting together. It was a time for 2 hours. But now it's down to 90 minutes where we get together, and we basically have dialogue, provocative talk around love, life, and relationships. And a self-honest self-evaluation. We don't shy away from some things need to be said, and we show up. And we basically go in on ourselves from time to time, and we appreciate you giving us a listen. I'm Mark Elliott. I'm going to bring in a cat that wasn't here last week, and he's here this week, and we're happy to have him back. You know what I'm talking about? The man that stole my matchbox and Hot Wheels when we were kids. And I always say, what's a klepto? There's always a klepto. Well, he's my cousin, so I keep him nearby me, and I'm trying to root out of his system. I don't know if I've done a good job, but we'll find out at some point. Mr. DeMaurice, how you feeling?
I was never going to let that go.
Let it go. Man, you can't take a man, a young man's toys like that. You can't do that, man.
It's funny, man. At the end of show, the NFL Pick Show, we were talking about Christmas and when did you stop believing in Santa Claus and toys. And me and Ice were talking about toys and how you wanted a G.I. Joe with the Kung Fu grip, and one of his friends had it, and he didn't have it, and I'm like, oh, man, I would have had that one. I just like Mark's the Matchbox cars. I would have stuck it up. I had to figure out a way.
Well, I got to swear, what's a klepto or is a klepto? Hide your stuff and visit the police ever come to your home. Man. They will put your toys away. So we missed you last week, bro. Good to have you here this time, and we're going to go through our talking and do some things. I want to kind of speak a little bit about what we're going to talk about next week. Not tonight, man, but I want to kind of give a little heads up to what we're going to talk about next week. In a sense, we're going to talk, in a sense, look into why are men choosing to be single? Because you look around, man, there's a lot of us are single. Why are we making that decision? We're going to talk about, do we really trust women? Could that be part of the reason why we're single? We spend a little time going and visiting there. So that should be interesting dialogue, just like every dialogue we tend to find tend to be interesting. But jumping back to this evening, bro, we're going to start out with something that I was thinking about, and I was like, whoa, this is okay. Boxing. You know, over the years, we've all been boxing fans. I go back to the days of Ali and Joe Frazier. And I was always a Joe Frazier fan based on the fact because my father was such a big Muhammad Ali fan, and I just wanted to root against my father. Even though I respect Muhammad Ali, and I thought he was great, but I wanted to be able to talk junk to my dad when Ali got beat. So that was why I kind of went with Frazier. But looking at boxing and looking at a man's life, and looking at your life in a sense, there's some things about boxing that kind of basically plays a role in your life, either day to day or year to year, that you, if you really take time to think about it, is how we may kind of roam through life in a sense. So it's interesting sometimes you go back and think that as a child, we gravitated to the things that kind of help us build a foundation as a man. And I don't think, I know boxing, as brutal as boxing sport was, and is today, there's some ways that boxing kind of helped us solidify us as the men we grew to be. So I'm going to throw that question to you first. When you think of boxing, when you look at your life, how does it kind of play into, you know, the rope or dope, stuff of that nature? How did it kind of play into one Mr. DeMaurice life, sir?
Some of the stuff I probably said before, but I look at life and boxing, and I'm old school, so I remember the fights used to be 15 rounds, and so I hope it goes back to 15 rounds. I don't know why they decided not to do 15 rounds, but I kind of looked at it as, you know, you got to do your training, you got to do your road work, you got to put the work in, and then when it's time to go out there and work and do everything you need to do, each round that you're out there, you're fighting. You're fighting life, you're fighting oppression, you're fighting all this stuff. And when you come to your corner, that's supposed to be when you're getting good advice and you're getting, stitched up if you got any cuts from being out there in the round and in the war, and getting some water, getting refreshed so you can go out there and tackle your opponent, which is life and oppression and all that other stuff. And I remember either you or another cousin of mine, I was when I was married, I was contemplating divorce, and they were, I think you and a friend of mine were asking me, why are you doing this, or what led you to this? And I said, I kind of look at this marriage as boxing. It's like I'm going out there and I'm fighting, you know, every day, fighting my heart out. But when I come to my corner, there ain't nobody in my corner that's willing to give me a chair to sit down so I can rest, give me some water, give me some encouraging words to go out there and fight. So if I'm fighting alone, then I need to really be alone. And so I kind of took that analogy of boxing to heart as far as, you know, why am I fighting to stay in this marriage if I don't have a corner to go to that's going to encourage me to keep going out there and fighting? What am I fighting for? Is it even worth fighting for? And so in everyday life, you know, you could take the boxing analogies of, some of the great fighters, some of the fighters that failed or get knocked out and coming back to fight another day. You could take a lot of the analogies, but I think that was the one that that kind of stuck with me when this question came up about being married and why I chose to get a divorce, kind of just comparing that boxing analogy. And it became so clear when I said it, they were like, okay, I got you. So to another guy, it's like, okay, I got how that might feel. So I get why you're doing what you're doing.
It's interesting, man, how we make the comparisons. We do. We use it. We make the comparisons. I look at it. I could kind of see exactly what you're saying. I could use that in my own particular situation. I'm going to go a little different route. I'm going to go a little different to where, just in life, and you remember sometimes in life where, you know, you were scored, I might have been squared up, and I'm trying to conquer something, and I got knocked down. And either I got back up quick, or while I was knocked down, I had to reevaluate, you know, while the ref is counting, one, two. I'm evaluating, or reevaluating when I get back up. What am I going to do different? How am I going to gain an edge to do this and accomplish this? So when I got back up, my approach was different. But I never stayed on the mat. I never gave up. I never laid out flat. And I just never stayed down. It makes me think of the movie. I think it was Raging Bull. Very good movie. And I can't remember the boxer that fought Joe Louis. But I think it was it might have been Rocky Marciano. But I always remember that scene in the movie where he says to him, "Joe, you didn't knock me out. you didn't knock me out, Joe. I'm still standing." Here's a man that's always standing strong. We got to get him in, and he's boxing hardcore, man. If you want to know anything about boxing, this is the cat you want to speak to. I'm talking about one Mr. Charles. Mr. Charles, we're going to bring you in. We're using boxing, and we're using it to show how it played in our lives in one form or fashion. I mean, the sport itself has changed over the years, but I know we're younger. You know, we took some things out of boxing and we use in our daily lives. And at the time, we probably weren't thinking about it, but now that we're of age, we look back and go, I was on the ropes at that point. Well, maybe I kind of, am I a little weaved? Am I a little ducking? So when you hear that, Mr. Charles, how has boxing transformed itself into your life, sir?
Probably several ways. Like I said, most times when I talk about stuff like this, I had to refer to my dad. And I think he was teaching me lessons because he know how crazy I was about sports. I was the ultimate sports fanatic. So if you could teach me something through sport, I buy into it. So, but when I think about boxing, I think about learning how to roll with the punches. You know, it's going to be something always going on. And you might get hit, but you got to keep rolling with them. You got to keep stay in there. You can't quit. Because in boxing, for the first time you get hit in the nose, a lot of times people want to quit or they cry when you're a kid. You just got to keep moving. Okay, you got to roll with the punches. Another thing that came to my mind would be stick and move. You just can't be a stationary target because people are always going to come after you. So you have to stick and move. And that's where, to me, you become more of a technician. And what that means in boxing along with life is just kind of move around and watch your opponent and kind of jab and do what you got to do and have a strategy. But then you can win that way by being subtle in your life and your approach. You can win that way by the mentality, using your strong mentality, or you can deliver the KO when needed. You can knock somebody out, not literally physically, but even mentally, you can knock them out. So that's what being a technician, you can either box in life, or you also can deliver a blow when needed, a knockout blow. And then I also think about stamina. How it's important to outlast your opponent. Your opponent might be thinking you're tired and they are dead tired because they haven't trained properly. And you're still standing, doing your thing. And also, it's important to outthink your opponent. Also, study your opponent. You're studying your opponents in life. People might be coming after you. It might be a supervisor or something that's giving you the blues on your job. You should study that person. Find out what makes them tick. And then you can also, when you do that, then you can anticipate a lot of their moves because you know them. And they're not, and people are creatures of habit. So I think about life and that. And then the end, you know, I think about it where although you may have support from the outside, you may even have corner work or whatever, even people that support you. But when you get in that ring in boxing, like in boxing, you're literally on your own. You're literally on your own. And no matter how much you train, no matter how much you go prepare yourself and somebody's right there whispering, even when you come back to the corner, they can't help you when you take that step into the ring. Oftentimes in life, the same way. They can talk you through it, give you great advice, but at the end of the day, you got to stand up on your own 2 feet and realize it's going to take the strength of you to stand up and persevere in life as well, just like in boxing.
There's another thing about boxing that we don't see in sports today. It doesn't ring as true now as it did back in the day. Remember when fighters in the past, you spoke of Mr. DeMaurice, how they would go 15 rounds and they would slug, man. Back in the day, they would slug for 15 rounds. But when the bout was over, they had love for the person that they were battling with. Even they were trying to knock out this person, man. The first thing you would see them do is walk up and hug each other, embrace. And you think to yourself, okay, for the past how many minutes you've been really trying to target this person, do away with them, do serious damage, do harm, if possibly knock them out. How in a split second, you hear ding, 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 you roll from that, and you basically – now embracing the person that was trying to basically knock your lights out. I think I want to take that and bring that to current day because you look at sometimes, I hate to even throw his name out there, but I'll throw his name, LeBron. I see Michael Jordan maybe done some of this too. I'm sure we've seen this where they might have lost a game or something and they walk off without embracing the person they played against. And I want to just ask, I'll come to you with this, Mr. Charles. I mean, thinking back to what I just said about boxing, what we grew up seeing, when you see that, how does that play with you?
Well, I mean, back in the day, it was, I think it was a matter of mutual respect, because both fighters knew what it took to get in the ring. You know, and that's that point where you, and I think you guys talking earlier about I was like Jake LaMotta and Sugar Ray Robinson, and he told you, you didn't knock me out, Ray, you didn't knock me out, you knocked me down. But it's like, you got to respect the guy, because many other people would have faltered. But in today's world, it's different, because the way that these people have ass do a lot of things, and everybody's thinking it's a me society. And it's like, as much as Ali gave Frazier the blues, talking about him all the time, at the end of the day, the one person that he said gave him more trouble than anybody was Joe Frazier. In that last fight, he said, you know, I almost died out there. I felt like I was dying. That's how hard it was. So he respected that man. So back in the day, when you knew how hard it was, what you had to do and what another person was doing in life, what you had to do to get to this point, and that person battled you that hard, that's true respect. Everything now is all easy and soft, and people just don't see it the same way. It's all about themselves instead of respecting the effort of another.
Double down on the word of respect, and that's what I see a lot. There's a lack of respect that we carry now for our opponents, for other men, or people in general, because we become so arrogant, so self-absorbed, to it's about us, what I'm trying to achieve, and we have forgotten some common decency, just respect. I mean, they do the same thing you do, and if your mama didn't and your daddy didn't teach you, you win some, you lose some. But you always carry a love of respect for the person that's against you. I mean, you lost, you lost. Mr. DeMaurice, you know, up to you with the same question. In a sense, you know, you've seen those two cats that I mentioned, and I don't even want to say their names again anymore, because sometimes I don't look at them always in a nice manner, some things they do. But when you see them handle themselves that way after losing, what are you thinking?
You know, to me, it's about sportsmanship. It's about gaining a mutual respect for the person you're going against. And I learned that playing football. But it keeps going on in life, because I think about me and in martial arts, and it's me and this brother who we're about the same age, and our Sifu is always teasing us, because when he pairs us up, he knows we're going to go at it. He knows. He likes to just sit there and just watch us go at it. But after we go at it, it's this mutual respect that I train just as hard as you. I respect you as a person. We could have gone at it. You could have got the best of me. I could have got the best of you. But if I'm making you better and you're making me better, we're going to be all right. And so I think sometimes what needs to happen, which I don't see in sports today, where it's sportsmanship, where we're in the same fraternity, we're doing the same thing, and we're working hard, and we're kind of privileged to kind of do this and be at a high, a high rate of doing this. I mean, just, you can't get no better than the NBA. You can't get no better than the NFL. And your competitors made it too. So just having a mutual respect, yeah, I want to win. Yeah, I want to beat you, but I don't want to maim you so you can't make money, that you can't kind of live the life you want to live. And so when I think about whatever LeBron or MJ do, and whether or not they shake hands afterwards or they give a hug and embrace, I think it's a level of respect you pay for your opponent, the privilege of being out there. People don't have to pay to watch you play, but the privilege of being out there and having an opponent that's going to bring out the very best in you and make the win even sweeter, or make you work harder to get the win, I think it becomes a mutual respect that this guy is taking just as much as he's given, and this guy is going to bring out the absolute everything you got to do what you need to do to win. Makes you a better person. Actually, after it's all over with, it makes you a better person. It gives you lessons learned. And afterwards, I know for me, when I'm going against my boy Dre, it's like, okay, I got to come back later. I got to work out these techniques or work out these bumps that I had here and come back even better. And I noticed that he does. So it drives each other. It's like the Bible verse, steel sharpens steel. And that's the way we look at it. Like, if I'm sharp, and even if we're not sparring or going at a chisao, where if I see him doing a technique and I'm like, nah, bro, you want to do it like this, you want to sharpen this, you want to do this, I'm still helping him be better. He's still helping me be better with me teaching him, and vice versa. He's like, hey, man, Don, you want to do this way. We're still sharpening each other, and that's that mutual respect we have for each other. Yes, we're competitors. Yes, we're trying to beat the snot out of each other in sparring or whatever, but we're trying to make each other better, and I think that's lost in sports and in manhood.
You drove a point that I was ready to make, man. It's definitely lost in manhood. And I'm going to put a question out to you, too, gentlemen. I'm going to come back to you in a little bit with this question, Mr. Demaryius. It's like, what goes into making a man? But before I put the question out here, I want to say this, because I think a lot of times as men, we forget that younger men are watching us. They may not be talking to us. They may not be asking us questions, but they're always paying attention to what we're doing. They may never be looking at you. And I think we lose sight of that fact where that even without saying a word, you're teaching and leading a younger cat. And so your actions, when you show a lack of respect, you show a lack of consideration, you're paving the way for them to think that's okay. And it's beyond yourself, that selfishness. And I think a long time ago, we forgot about that. We forgot that we paved the roads for cats to come behind us. Now, we tend to believe, you know, we paved the road for us to go in, and we close the door behind us. And it's a sad, to me, it's a sad state of affair. We should always be thinking. So when we speak of those two on a high level where everyone's watching, and the commentators act like they're so into it, they just don't want, no, it's deeper than that. And I know sometimes they say, well, they don't have responsibility. Yes, you do. You do. Whether you want it or not, you do. You have that responsibility to others to show them. And to me, how bigger a man can you be when you are defeated? You can sum up inside of you to show respect and show honor to another man. Think about that for a second. A punk can walk off salt and act like I got my ass kicked. But a real man stands there and faces defeat. But you know when they win, they laugh and they pour in the champagne, here goes again. So it's not always a man in a sense when things are going good. Who are you when things are not going your way? That's what I want to see sometimes. I don't want to see you when everything is great and you smile and you're cheering. I want to see when your ass is getting kicked. What man are you then? Because that's what tells me a lot about you. So with that being said, Mr. Reese, I'm going to come back to you with the question, what goes into making a man?
One of the things that I remember is that I was kind of the youngest cousin hanging around you guys and my other cousins back in the South. And one of the things I think I talked to Mr. Childs about is that we live in a day and age where participation awards are more honored than, you know, you fighting and earning a spot and fighting and earning your respect. And so I remember playing basketball or football with the older guys, and they weren't giving you anything. you had to earn it. In order to get on the field, you got to earn it. In order to get picked, you had to earn it. It wasn't, oh, I was just going to put him on here. So, you know, and then just give him, you know, little easy ways to do things. You had to earn it. If you wanted a layup, you wanted an easy shot, you had to go in the paint. That time, it wasn't no, you could call a foul. You got knocked down, you got back up, you ain't called no foul, whether you missed it or you made it. And I think that's what I think is missing from manhood now, is that we're not making folks earn stuff. We're just kind of giving folks stuff. And what lessons do you learn with just getting stuff without working hard to get it? And so I know it's sports related, but it made you work harder. It made you practice a little bit more. It made you go out there and play other folks to go, okay, what do I need to do to get better so I can keep up with these guys? Whether it was playing basketball, whether it was playing kill the man with the football or football games, whether it was weightlifting, whether it was boxing, whether it was anything, it was like, okay, in order for you to stay here and earn your respect, you got to work for it. You got to work hard for it, and you're not going to be given a win. You got to earn a win. And you're not going to be given a basket or a touchdown or a pass. You had to earn it. And I think that's what is missing with a lot of males that I see today is that they never get to earn it. They never get in positions where they have to earn it. It's always given. And so when they get put in positions where they have to earn it, they quit. And men aren't quitters. We're not quitters. And so that's what I see with a lot of young men. If it doesn't go their way, they tend to quit or make excuses on why they can't do it instead of getting back in the lab, working out harder, and then coming back stronger. And I believe that makes you a man that, okay, I did fall down, but what do I need to do to get back to a spot where I'm winning, where I don't fall down, where I don't get knocked out? I think that's a big piece that's missing, man.
Woo! I'm going to say this, man. I remember years ago I worked at this radio station, and we always had weekly meetings. And I loved a part of our meetings. This was one of the things that we always said, no excuses. It just was none. If something ain't getting done, you got to own up to it. If we're trying to accomplish something with the station, it didn't happen, if someone didn't carry their weight, we looked at you, we need you to fess up, here's what you're going to do better, here's what you're going to do different. We didn't tolerate excuses. And excuses have become commonplace for us as men. Really is. We'll find any excuse to justify some bad behavior, some bad things we're doing, how we treating women, anything, man. We'll find excuses. And like you said, real men don't quit. You can take a break. You can definitely take a break, but quitting for the most part coming up wasn't even an option. You gonna quit what? what you quitting? It wasn't, and there was no excuse. You know, people didn't look at you to have an excuse. If you have an excuse, they give you one. But excuses have become commonplace, a way to be settling for not trying to do your best, or when your best is not done, not pushing beyond to make it your best. Mr. Charles, what goes into making a man?
Part of it is examples, man. You need examples. And unfortunately, I think we've lost that because there are a lot of men who are not with their children, or they walked away, or the situation is not right. And then we don't always have other men to set examples. And then sometimes when young men have examples, they're bad examples. I know we're going to talk later about family, but there are some bad damn examples. And you're like, that's all you know, is watching it from that standpoint. But I think part of it is also understanding how hard life can be. And that's where those hard lessons come in. I remember when I was like 11 years old playing baseball, I wanted to play baseball. And my dad played baseball. He's a catcher. So I'm excited where we lived at, wanted to play baseball and whatnot, going to play right around the corner from my house. My father said, uh-uh. You want to know how to play baseball? You're going to play the right way. I was like, well, right way is about 5 minutes away, right, at the park. He put me in the car, drove me across town to where he used to play, and man, it was the neighborhood, and it was hardcore. And I didn't know how to play, really. And I had to learn, bro. I had to learn. I remember it was myself and two other guys. There was only two positions left on the team to start, right field, and I couldn't catch a cold, and third base. And it was three guys for two spots. And man, it was ugly, but I made it. But the whole point of it is, it was a lesson that I endured, and then I got better and better. I ended up, starting at third base. But I learned. But the other parts of it too is just really taking time to understand, not to be a quitter, but also realize that things are not going to be easy. But you have to build confidence in the individual, in the young man. It's about building confidence and realizing that sometimes you're going to fall short. sometimes things are not going to go your way. But you, as you guys mentioned earlier, you have to rise up, stand up, and keep going. Have to keep going. And sometimes it can be brutally hurtful, and you might even want to shed a tear. But after you shed a tear or two or whatever, time to get your ass up and let's go. Time to keep moving forward, man. You have to do that because if you have to get yourself together first, even before you can even think about having a family and having other people taking care of other people, having other people counting on you. If you're not right, how the hell can you take care of somebody else? And I think that's part of it. Getting yourself together mentally and physically for this grind. And this grind of life is hard as hell.
Can I jump in real quick?
I think that. Oh, please help yourself.
I'll give you an example of this. We talked about this before. Me, you, and your brother used to lift weights all the time. And there was no taking the weights off when it came to me. So I'm working out with people, and they're like, man, why are you so strong, bro? Like, man, I'm like, and I tell them the story. I'm like, when I worked out with my cousins and older cousins, there was no taking off. No, we're going to take off the weight for you so you can do it. No, we'll spot you. But we're taking off the weight. You're gonna have to man up and get to this point where we are. So I'm like, you're like, whoa, okay. I said, yeah, because there was no, oh, we're gonna take time. We had places to go, things to do. Take time, take off the weights, and put the big weights back on. Nah. You're gonna lift what we lift. You're gonna do what we do, and that's it. And I think Mr. Charles is right. We don't have examples. We don't have enough examples for young men like that where you see folks go, okay, this is the way you do it. This is how you do it. This is the way you step into manhood. We just don't. It's all on TV and social media now.
And those two places are the wrong place for it to be taught, bro, and be looked at and to be duplicated because they're not showing a good version of it. They're just not, man. And I'll go back to what I said earlier. We have to keep in mind that just the simple things we're doing, they're paying attention to. And they may not have no one else to look at other than you. So you always, to me, should be on point in doing what should be something that they can look at, learn from, think about, and get something from it. Mr. Charles, I want to go back to something you said, man. If you don't mind, real quickly, you was talking about, I had it in my head and I just lost it. You were saying about the outfield. You said it was left field. There was a name you threw on there. Give me that again. You said left field. What was it?
I was like the third base and left field. Left field.
Okay, I thought you said something you couldn't. I thought you said something in some spot where you couldn't catch a cold.
You couldn't catch a cold.
No, I couldn't catch a cold. Yeah, I couldn't catch a cold. That's why I couldn't play the outfield. I couldn't catch a cold. Yeah. You know, that let you can't. You had no hands. You can't catch a cold.
Yeah.
I have no way of I couldn't judge the ball. When I thought it was coming up, I'm going back. When I thought it was going back, I'm going up. I mean, I could not judge the damn ball. And the only reason why that I played third base was this. The coach put me out there, you know, that's the hot corner. So stuff come off third base, it can kill you, hit you in the head, anything. So the coach would, you know, they give you the basic. They hit the ball where they would give you the, they would hit, get you, all right, let's get one. Means you, the body hit the ball to you and you throw the first base, put it out. So he would hit the ball towards me and he would hit it and I would kind of see it coming and I would jump the other way, away from the ball. So I would jump out the way from the ball. So, you know, he did it like three times. And I jumped the one way. So one time he would wait, and he went to hit the ball, swing the bat and hit the ball towards me. Let's get one. And he whiffed like he faked me out like he was going to hit the ball, but he didn't. I jumped, and he hit the ball right at me. So the ball hits me in my body, then it hits me in my head. He hits me, get one. Four times in a row, my dad's there. The ball hits me, and it hurts. And I look at my dad, I'm like, well, my dad was like, shit, what? What you going to do? And I was like, damn, he killing me over here. So after a while, that fifth time, he hit the ball, I didn't run. I grabbed it, I snagged it, I threw that damn ball to first base. Get one. Hit one and again. I became one of the best third basemen over in that league because I was mad. I didn't want to be hit no damn more, and my dad wasn't saving me. So get one.
I don't know if Mr. Charles remembers this, but we used to play, I think, intramural softball in Wilberforce. And the team I played for, I played third base. And Charles came up to me one day, like, "You on that hot corner like Brooks Robinson, ain't you?" Because I don't know if you play third place. And he said, "You on that hot corner. You on that hot corner like Brooks Robinson. You scooping it up like Brooks Robinson, throwing it to first." And, you know, you learn that when you're playing ball when you're younger. If you didn't know how to play, you couldn't play. You had to be on the sideline. You could not play. And these kids don't get that. If they can't play, they go back to video games. They go to social media. They do all kind of stuff. It's like they quit, and then they go on to something else that they feel like they're better than. But you don't have the coaches. Now, if the coach did that, what he did to Charles now, oh, he'd be in the news. Why he hit that little boy with that ball? That's child abuse. But it taught that man, hey, I got to stay here and face this. And those are the lessons that get lost in this.
I love his father reaction, man. His father reaction, he didn't even move. That I love. Drove you to get hit by a ball. I love that. Gentlemen, let's take a little quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the family nuances, man. Mr. Charles said it earlier. We're going to talk about family because I always say nobody loves you like family. Nobody loves you like family. Mr. Charles, Mr. Dean Reese, Mark Elliott. Something and you kind of believe that it's just you. You might be experiencing something and you think, okay, I'm just the only one. I'm the only one. This big wide world that's going through this. And then you start to talk to others and you realize you're not alone. And the family nuance is something that you realize things that go on in your family. Then you say to yourself, okay, you know, this is just my family. And then you have conversations and you look out and you realize, no, it's just not yours. It's just not yours. It's families everywhere. And it's that family nuance. And we were talking a couple of days ago at the end of the sports show. And Mr. DeDeuce, I'm going to come to you to get this started, man, because you laid it out, bro. And it was based on support, in a sense. And we started there and we really covered a lot. But if you don't mind, I'm going to come back to you, and you give us what you gave us that evening, man, and we'll go from there, sir.
Yeah, one of the things that we were talking about was about how people kind of hate on you. And we talked about it from our culture, black people hating on each other. For some reason, we can't support each other. But one of the things that I pointed out is like, a lot of the hate that came to me in my life didn't just come from black people, but came from people in my own family. And when you kind of strive to be better or that you've done something or accomplished something, you would think that your family members would say, you know, let's rally, let's support this particular person. You know, they're doing you know, above and beyond. They had a great accomplishment. But nah, it doesn't. Matter of fact, you find out that they are kind of hating on you and they're kind of jealous of what you accomplished. And if it was somebody outside the family, you could see them praising that person, but you do the same thing and they're looking at you like you did them wrong. And so I always say, you know, and I see it all the time and I see it from different cultures where family hate is very prevalent in cultures, but I did not see as much hate as black families hate on black members of the family. It's a venom that I don't see in other families. You do see it in other families in different cultures, but when it comes to black on black hate, as far as family hating on family members or not supporting family members or talking about family members in a negative way, it just seems like it goes to a whole nother level when it comes to us. So I noticed that when I finished college, when I finished grad school, when I wrote my first book, when I became, you know, when I started to move up in different positions in life, the more you start to do, the more you see that kind of hate. So when I brought that question out, I wanted to see whether or not other folks were seeing that too. And then where is this coming from? Because I thought, you know, we were blood. For me, if a family member made it somewhere or did something, I'm supporting them. I'm like, you know, because that's part of me. That's part of my blood. That's part of the family, and I'm very proud of that. But I don't always see that. And I've gotten used to it over the years. Sadly to say, I've gotten used to not getting that support or getting that praise or acknowledgement from my family. I get it from all different directions. So I don't look for it anymore. But that shouldn't be. That really shouldn't be.
No, you're right, man. Now, I'll just say this. If you're waiting for family of black people to support you, encourage you, bro, you've been waiting a long time. And you hit on a word of jealousy, which is interesting, because a lot of it where it comes from is that there is jealousy. Not jealousy that they think you're better than them, but the mere fact that you're aspiring and to do things and you're accomplishing things shows them up, because they're not about doing jack, and they don't want you doing jack. You accomplishing and doing things make them feel less than who they are, and they don't have it within them to be any better than what they are. They know they don't have it within them. They're not even going to push. They're not thinking about achieving or accomplishing. So therefore, they take it and they spend it to basically flatten your tires, because their tires have been flattened a long time ago based on their laziness, pure laziness, no ambition, no thought. And they find those in the family and even outside the family to connect with and hang with. It's like the old saying, misery loves company. So they find that. And it's easy. It's easy to basically attached to the negativity, speak about it. Instead of making your bed easier to lay in as you're trying to accomplish and gain, bro, they want nothing to do with it. What you experience is nothing different than what I experience. Seriously. And it's ironic that, and I said this the other night, I look at some of the things I've done that I've kind of said to myself, I want to do this. And at the time, I might have thought I want to become one time a recording engineer. And I said, man, how the hell am I going to do such? And there was a chance to go to school for it. I'm not going to school for years. So I'm just not going to do it. And I said, okay, maybe there's some cats out there I can basically learn under and try to. When I started really kind of researching this, there was none out there that I came across in my area that looked like me. So I'm thinking, I don't stand a chance, bro. I don't stand a chance. But I'm not going to let that deter me. I'm going to go out there and do what I got to do. Moving out there and taking this on, I went out to speak. And what I found was, in this particular area, that people that don't look like me, when they're realizing that you're serious about what you're trying to accomplish and you're a good person, they will break their back to help you. These are white folks, bro. They will break their back to help you. Just that point. So I started speaking to a couple of guys that was doing roadies. And here again, none of them look like me. At first, when I brought the conversation to them, it looked like, you know, they were like, what the hell is he talking about? But then the conversation would take off and they would just start talking. Here's what you need to do. Maybe talk to this person. There was a guy that has a studio not too far from where I live. I didn't even know it exists, a recording studio. I called him one day out of the blue. Hey, my name is so-and-so. You know, I'm looking to get in. I'm thinking about doing this to get. He said, you know what, they ain't going to teach you much, but you know what, go do it. It's a good experience for you. We talked a little bit. Before I hung up the phone, he said, do me a favor. He said, go do that. He said, when you finish, give me a call. Did what I was planning on doing. Came back, gave him a call. He brought me by a studio. When you walk, this place was a recording studio. When you're outside, you just thought it was a building, bro. You go inside, it was elaborate. And I walked in there, and it's like, man, the doors open up, bro. So from that, him, I started working for him. Learned some things. Learned. I'm going to say this, and I'm coming to you with this, Mr. Charles, about the family, but here's a cat don't look like me. Didn't know me from a hole in the wall. Talking to him on the phone. He could hang the phone up on me. And I'll leave it with this. Years ago, I was in Philadelphia. Big fan of the Philadelphia Sound, Teddy Pendergrass, Harold Melvin, the Blue Notes. You name him. This is really recorded. So I was in town visiting a friend one day, and she drove me by the studio. Here again, you ride by. It looked like a town off, nothing going on, where all the stuff was done. And I said to her, you know, I want to go inside. He said, well, you know, they may not let you, but how about you just go give it a shot? Went by, buzzed. Little did I know there was a camera at the time. I'm buzzing the door. I hear a voice. And he said, what'd you do? I said, you know, I'm down from Connecticut. I said, I'm an assistant recording engineer. I said, I'm really starting to learn some things. I said, I'll just like to come in and walk around and just see the studio where some of my favorite artists record. Door buzz open. This cat walks up to me, shakes my hand. He took me on his tour. I'm telling you, bro. When he took me inside the place, the room where Teddy Pendergrass stood and recorded, man, I can't tell you how great that was. I can't tell you. So I'm saying to say this, and we're going to ask this question in a little bit. Does black people really love black people? Because we act like it. We talk about it. We put it in slogans. But when I look around sometimes, I'm not sure. I'm just not sure. But, Mr. Charles, coming to the Family Nuances, man, you know, you were part of a conversation we had a few days ago, and we want, if you like, to share some things you should share then, or you can share some things different.
Yeah, it's bizarre because when you talk about family, we all know how we grew up, right? And then it's almost as if when if somebody makes it or does something different as an accomplishment, some people seems as if they have they get amnesia, right, as to what it was. And it's like how things work. We grew up the same way. We're the same blood. We came up. We're both struggling. Our family struggled. This happened to me. Like, for instance, and this is a little different. I have a cousin, and we're first cousins. And she does pretty well for her life. And she saw, you know, I went to school and whatnot. And but when it comes to stuff like even vacations, like, she'll call and say, hey, what are you doing? How you doing? All right, whatever. We get into a conversation. And then she'll say, where are you? What you doing? I said, I'm in Vegas. And she goes, you always going to Vegas. I'm like, what? You always going to Vegas. You need to do something else. And I'm like, what are you talking about? She says, you need to do something else. I'm like, she says, you always going to Vegas. You could be spending your money doing something else. I was like, hold up. Do I call you and tell you what to do when you with your life and with your money? She said, I never get to go. You don't never take me. I was like, well, if you quit buying cars, and that's what I wanted to say. I couldn't say that. You quit buying cars and buying stuff that you can't afford, then you can go to Vegas too. My thing is, I like Vegas. I like being in certain places, so I don't spend extra money because I need my money to be in Vegas. And it just blew, it just floored me in a sense. Because her attitude towards it was like, I was doing something wrong, or if I was doing something she wished she could do, and she was jealous about it. But the other part is, Mr. DeMaurice said he said it the right way, is even when you are making accomplishments that really are very, very difficult for you to get to where you're at, some people are still jealous, and I'm like, you even had a better opportunity than I did. And I think about undergraduate school, and I think about graduate school. I'm like, do you know what my GPA was in high school? I had less than a 2.0 in high school. I'm serious, overall. That's why I graduated with less than a 2.0. And it took a lot of work to get to that point because colleges weren't letting people in like that. So for somebody to belittle it, like, you know, somebody just gave me something. It's like, damn, if you put the work in, if you do something well, I'm going to be the first person to go, congratulations. That must be great for you. You must feel honored. And I'm going to give you your love. But when your own people start hating on you because you made something, an accomplishment that was hard as hell, now you wish you could. Sometimes you think you want to dismiss them. Or sometimes you have to remove them and put them at a certain place in your life. that you can't be around them all the time, because that sometimes that can be, that attitude can be very toxic.
To say the least, I remember something my mother said to me a long time ago, and I replied to a family, bro. She said, you can't feed everybody with the same spoon. Now, if I want you close to me, I'm going to feed you with a shorter spoon. But I deem that you're no longer good for me. Your energy, your negativity is not good. My spoon for you is going to be very long. I'll feed you. I may associate with you, but the spoon is much longer. Here's what I find interesting about family and black people in general. As you mentioned, you talked about, when you accomplish these things, they treat it like nothing happened. If you were to do a crime, Mr. DeMaurice, and you went to, you were going to jail, they would have told you the lavish cookout party they could have thrown, bro. When you came home from college, you came home. Same with you, Mr. Charles. You two came home. You probably didn't get a damn balloon. You didn't get a balloon. You would have went to jail. 2, 3, 10 years. Came home. You would have got a key to their fucking house. Excuse my language. A party would have been thrown for you. What type of mentality is that? I mean, when you think about it, what type of mentality is that? Let's think about that for a second. This is happening every day in our community, realistically, every day. And that's why you see me sometimes salute folks that we don't hear nothing about, that's doing some great things, because we don't do it as a race of people. We just don't. We treat our accomplishments like, eh. You know, if you ain't basically, you know, swinging your ass or something like that, we treat it like it's no big deal. Are you kidding me? Are you spitting into a microphone, not using good language, or good grammar, or whatever? We love you for that. The mentality, I just don't understand. But it's the truth. If you were to do one of those other two, going to jail or did something, bro, trust me, your reaction, what they would have gave you, was different. And like I said, I experienced a lot of the same things. I moved and decided to basically, when I was younger, to work at a different radio station. Bro, you would have thought, my brother and sister, I took money out of their account when they weren't paying attention. You know, you'd have thought, in the middle of the night, I came and took money out of their account and asked, but that's how they responded to it. I didn't have time to figure out why. I didn't care. But it's just amazing how family doesn't support each other. So if black families ain't supporting each other, how are black people supporting each other? And there goes the question. There sets the foundation for the question. Mr. DeMaurice, it's interesting. Do black people love black people?
I'm not sure, man. I know people. I know some black people who love black people, and they're going above and beyond, doing some things to uplift us and help us move forward. But sometimes it gets slowed down almost to a halt with people who don't like us. Because we look the same, and it's a struggle trying to uplift folks who don't want to be uplifted, who don't like who they are, don't know who they are, don't care to know who they are. And but you did get those black folks who, I guess, they see how we're being treated out from folks outside the race, and don't see the worth in us, and kind of look at it through the lens of our oppressors or folks that don't look at us. And so I guess they take the attitude sometimes, well, you can't beat them, let's join them. So if they hate you, I'm going to hate you too. Well, I'm going to hate the person that I am that is like you and do something totally different and do something opposed to what I'm supposed to do with my people and for my people. So there are some people who are fighting, but they are few and far between. But you see most of the folks who say you can't beat them, join them. It's interesting. The other night I was watching a movie called Ma Rainey's Black Bottom on Netflix with Chadwick Boseman and Viola Davis and a few other great actors. And you kind of saw this play out in that particular presentation, where you get to the point where you hate yourself and what people do to you so much that you turn against people who look like you. And it, to me, it was like, it's the hate that I have of being like you that I want to kill, which may explain why some brothers want to kill other brothers or don't think twice about killing other brothers, because I hate that I look like you. I hate that I'm being treated like you. So I want to kill that hate. I can't get to the people I want to get to, or I'm afraid of getting to the people I want to get to, but I'm going to kill you because you're closest to me. And I'm going to kill what I hate in me through you. So it's really frustrating to be in that situation and to watch it play out day after day after day, especially here in Chicago. But that's the reality of it, that you get the impression, and people outside the culture get the impression that, man, black folks don't even like black folks. So why are we struggling trying to help them get whatever when they don't even like themselves?
I'm going to double down and say we don't, bro. Yeah, I'm going to triple down, just be honest with you. We don't. And it's for various reasons, but we don't. And you really define some in your response. But part of the reason, psychologically, this is just my thinking, and I don't ask anybody to agree with me, no one, but when you take a word that's been used to basically denigrate your people, and you take a word that basically responds to you as being ignorant, and you make that become your daily language that you feed to your mind, if you ever notice, listen to a conversation that when a black person is talking about another black person, they call them a nigga. Listen with the intensity and the force that they use when they say that word. And you got people playing around, also affecting, but listen to, just one day be aware of that. Listen to how when they just say that about someone else, when they're talking about them, ferocity that comes off when they say that word. That's deep, bro. So when you got that inherently inside of you, it's been fed to you, it's embedded inside your core, how are you going to turn around and look at me and love me? How is that possible? You've been taught not to love me. You've been taught. And you're not even smart enough. Fuck being weak. I hate when people talk about wake up. You're not even smart enough to understand. You've been taught that. You're doing their work for them. It's been programmed, manufactured. And that's how, to me, that's a big part of it. And I'm not saying that word is all our ills, but has been taught to us to use against us, to not like, not to love each other. It's what it is. Mr. Charles, your reaction, sir?
I'm not going to, I guess for me, I think it's partial. I'm not going to say that we don't love us. There are certain situations there. Some of us are ignorant. Some of us don't love us because we don't know any damn better, or with our experiences, we don't give a damn. I get that. I'm with that all day. But there are so many people that I've connected with, and you two brothers along, that I'm not just going to throw that away. I can't do that, because if that's the case, then I'm lost, bro. If I don't believe in me loving my brothers and my sisters, people that matter to me, I'm lost. Now, in general, as black people, we can't save everybody, but you even look back at the points of slavery, man. I think about Harriet Tubman, about how many times she went back and forth to save people that weren't even her people. And even her own people, that she couldn't even bring them back because they weren't ready and they were ignorant enough to the situation. They were scared. So I'm going to say, I think a lot of us love us, but there are some exceptions. There's some, especially with the younger people, because the younger people too now, the world is so much different for them that even with that word we won't mention, it's more of a term of endearment. They just throw it around like it's nothing, and I think that's the reason why, because they never experienced anything. They never meant anything to them. But when you've been through it and you know, for instance, on our end, at least for my situation, what my dad had to go through living through Jim Crow and all that other mess, it meant something. So that word means something. But I'm going to say that I think for me and the people that I care about and certain ones, some of us do love us. I wish it was more, but it's not. But I the only thing I had to hold on is I am proud as hell to be a black man because of what I've experienced in the history. And nothing else, the history of what we overcame as a people. Does that mean everybody? Does that mean we need a lot of work? We need a lot of damn work. But without me standing still and holding that those values and the core values of how people made it through, shit, my life was, I wouldn't have anything, man. I wouldn't have anything. And granted, like I said, that's not the beginning and the end of it, but I have to hold on to those core values, man, because I'll be damned. I'm telling you, there is nothing like being a man, a black man, bro. Like I was telling D. Maurice before, when you hear a song, and I know this is trivial, you hear a song come on the radio, is there something about that song that make you bob your head? You already know, bro. It is nothing like it in the world. I may never be a rich man, but I'm damn sure rich because I'm African American. I'm a black man. I'm rich all day, baby. I wouldn't trade that for nothing in the world.
Ladies and gentlemen, you see why I go to battle with these gentlemen any day of the week. I love them both because this is what we do. You know, we don't take shortcuts. We ain't about trying to agree. We ain't trying to make anyone happy. When black men talk, this is what you get. Honest, pure, unfiltered talk, conversation. Not afraid to approach anything. Not afraid to not speak on anything. That's what I love about it. Let's take a little break. We'll come back. We got questions coming from Mr. Charles and Mr. DeMaurice. It's When Black Men Talk. Mark Elliott, Mr. Charles. I said earlier when I came on, you know, find your friends, two friends, and pick a date and time to talk for 90 minutes. 90 minutes, yeah. But do me a favor, if you get together and talk about 90 minutes, please don't talk about gossip, hearsay, don't talk about what Jay-Z, Beyonce is doing and the song Wet and all other stuff. Find some things to really, some substance, some things to really talk about. You know, challenge your friends. Because it's not interesting. I mean, to me, I'm not. It's going to say it's not interesting. I think, you know, our conversations sometimes need to be deeper among ourselves. If anybody can get on the phone and laugh about dumb stuff that's on Facebook, realistically, how about we as people open our minds, open our conversations to stronger conversations and stronger thoughts? Mr. Charles, your question, sir.
Yeah, since we're talking about family, I want to know if there's ever been a time where you had a disagreement or a tough exchange with a relative that caused you to go away from one another for a while. And if you came back to that person when you started talking again, was it ever the same?
Not with my immediate family. But there's a relative of mine that your relationship has not. I went away from him for a little while and have not been the same. I guess I can't tolerate buffoonery anymore. But I have a cousin that he changed his name when he was younger to become a Muslim. And throughout the years, just kind of being around him, you know, I've seen some things he did. I didn't agree with, I didn't like. We always had a conversation. He kind of never, you know, we never kind of seen eye to eye, but he was my cousin. I love him. And I watched him go from basically doing cocaine to stop doing cocaine. He used to play the three-card Molly, stop doing that. So he kind of proved himself in some areas. But there were certain substances as a man he just never, to me, owned up to. And there's something, I mean, I see him not tend to his kids. And he's a little older than me. And one day, a few years ago, I was moving. Now, I'm prior to this, I've basically helped him out in a lot of different areas. And he's, if he needed something, I was there for him. Now, he's getting monetary. There's some things he might need. I was always there. So one day I said to him, I need you to help me move on Sunday. And he said, I don't move anymore. I said, I'm going to say that what I just said to you again, bro. I need you to help me move on Sunday. I'm coming to pick you up 11 o'clock. He fussed a little bit, but he did. When I went to go pick him up, he was there. But what he tried to do when he was helping me move, he tried to make it as difficult as possible, and he kept running his mouth. And there was a few times I wanted to pop him in the mouth. I said, you know what? I need this brother to get this movement done. So I'll hold off until the proper time. So after the movement was done, I took the truck back, dropped him off. I took a day or two to calm down. And I called him. And he thought I was calling to give him money, to pay him. And I said to him, I said, I've been around you for X amount of time. And I said, there's not been many times I've asked you for anything. And I said, the one time I asked, this is how you come off? I said, you and I are no longer will be cousins as we once were. He said, no, man, you had a lot. I said, no, just think about this. I asked one time. I don't care if you had a broken leg. All that's been given to you, for you to act the way you act and behave the way you behave, bro, there's no way in my good grace I can continue on as my cousin. And we've never been the same, bro. For years, I kind of avoided him. If he was around, I was uncordial to him. And it just got to the point where I just no longer wanted to associate with him. And to this day, we were good for years, bro. But here again, that's my nature. You know, I can be to you what you may need or help, or the case may be. But the one time I need something from you, you got to come correct. You got to come correct. So, yes, I mean, I don't think that because we are blood, we have to be together. But I will say this. My mother passed. You know, her one of her wishes always was before she passed is that we stay close together for our brothers and sisters, that we stay together, we hang together, and we continue on as brothers and sisters when she's no longer here. Out of five, sometimes I think I'm the only one that kind of heard that. I think I'm the only one kind of heard that wish and tried to grant it. And I'm glad that I did because, for the most part, I've stayed and stayed connected. This is sometimes I could definitely have walked away from them. I may have taken a short little break, but I come back and I work it through with them because that's what she wanted. And for what my mother has given to me, she carried me for 9 months in her womb, didn't know who I was, the way she loved and raised me. And if she can speak that to my heart, you know, if they don't get it, that's their problem. But for me, I feel like it's a responsibility and an obligation to honor her in such a way. And I'm surprised sometimes that they don't see it that way. And I'm going to tell you this before I move over to you, Mr. DeMaurice. Ironically, Ms. DeMaurice, you know this, our grandfather was a minister. So we grew up around the church. And after I got to be a certain age, man, I didn't hang out in the church that much. Even to this day. You might, if you see me walking through a church, the church may rumble, bro. But you, if the COVID wasn't going on, they would be in church every day. They got titles, this and that, whatever the case may be. So what good is all that doing you? If it's not in your heart, you're not living it. Mr. DeMaurice, your response.
Yeah, as you were sitting there talking, I thought about when I was about 16 years old, me and my dad almost came to blows. And we didn't. And I'm always thankful for that, where we restrained from going after each other physically. But I think me standing toe-to-toe with him, I think both sent us a message. I think for him, it sent him a message that I got to change my ways because what I did was wrong. And for me, it sent a message that I couldn't hit this man because it would be like hitting myself. And so I think a few months went by, and then we finally sat down and we talked about it. And it made us closer, more transparent. We became closer than I ever thought we would be, to be able to talk to each other about anything. But to me, in retrospect, it had to get to that point for us to get to that point. And our relationship, after we almost came to blows, became stronger because we realized how much we loved each other, how much we might have hurt each other, and that the relationship between us needed to be healed for us to be who we wanted to be in each other's lives. So I understand other family members there have been other family members where I'm like, you know, I'm done with them. I don't want to be a part of their lives. And I have family members like that. But with me and him, it was something that was a catalyst of something that I cherish to this day, our relationship to this day. So it didn't end bad. It just woke us up to what kind of relationship do we want to have? Do I really love this person with my whole heart? And it made us both examine that. And then we did what we had to do to make that bond stronger and make that relationship one of the best relationships I have with a family member.
I'll say this, man, if I go, Mr. Charles, man, I have had the honor to tease and be teased by your father for years, bro. You know, we go way back. And he's always been that man to me, man. Your father's always been, I mean, I just look at him and we tease out of love. Mm-hmm. You know, I always knew that, and we teased your father, man. It was nothing better when I was younger. If I got the best of your father teasing him, your father would kick his head back and start laughing, man. He would just break into a laughter. it was rough. That was like putting money in my pocket to see that, man. And even now, in our football picks, with your father kicking my ass sideways and left. We still tease each other. I'm thankful for that, bro. I'm thankful, man. And mm-hmm. I'm happy that thing worked out with you and your dad. I'm happy that you and your father have what you two share now and what's going on. You're blessed, more than blessed, beyond blessed, man, that even to be able to pick up the phone and he's there. And I don't know if you guys talk about the little rascals, man, but you know, to be able to do the football picks, he's part of it. And, you know, that to me, bro, is priceless. Priceless, man. And I salute you two for it. Mr. Charles, answer to your question, sir.
Yeah, there's been a few, but, my family, because of my situation, when I have, like, really blood brothers and sisters, my cousins have been, like, very close to me, different ones, right, different ages. So family has always been everything because it's like it's based on our name and we take care of one another. So there was an instance where a cousin was out of town, came in from out of town and brought a friend in with him, one of his female friends. And we have another cousin. We all had those cousins in your life that probably on the other side of the law, nothing crazy, but just, you know, they're doing some things they probably shouldn't be doing, right? And this particular person, one of the other cousins was talking to the female about this cousin. And the way they described him was like, wow, is that what you said? And started to laugh about it. I'm like, I mean, why would you do that, talk about family like that? I mean, what we say about our people, we say about our people because that's our people, right? But to say the way you did to tell other people outside the circle is like, that's taboo, bro. So I didn't bring it up at first, but we took a trip on I think it was like a family reunion. I mentioned it, and then they went out, all our drama, then a lot of big words were said, and it got heated. And then the person acted as if they wanted to fight me. So I was like, oh wow, Because I asked you about something, and they told me they thought I was tough. And I was like, wow, okay, so now you're feeling yourself. And I told them, believe me, the only reason why I'm not in your ass right now is because I thought we were family. And they went to this whole thing, how they took care of me, his family and everything. But anyway, long story short, we ended up coming back around, and we had a person that was an intermediary in it. And we're civil and we're okay now. And, you know, I took some trips and did some things with him when nobody else was there, and it's almost as if he forgot that. But we're civil, but it can never be the way that it was. And it's not because I'm mad or angry. The main thing is because we're in different parts of places in our lives. And if I did need something, or if I did say to myself, hey, he's important to me because for this reason or another, it's no longer there. I'm civil and whatnot, but it's not, nah, it's just not the same. Because we're not the same people, and we're going different directions. And that's okay. That's okay. So that, yeah, the answer to the question is, nope.
Yeah, I think realistically, man, especially for family, I think you have to work overtime to not allow things like that to occur. That's always been my thought process. And I speak of my cousin. You know, he just showed me in that scenario. Nothing I didn't know before, but it's too selfish for me to just kind of really keep putting myself around you. And when your selfishness hits home with me, then I must react to it. And as much as I would love for most families or all families to get along, but sometimes you just can't, bro. You just can't. For the betterment of you, sometimes we can't. And some people will fight to make it try to work to their own detriment. And there's only one you. You know, if you know you're standing on solid, good ground, you've done the best you could to make it work and make it be sustainable, and it's not, then it's time not to see it for what it is. To see it for what it is. And the same cat I was talking about, he's a little older than me. He's bouncing from house to house to live with family members. And they get tired of him after a period of time, and they put him out. So, I mean, some things speak for themselves. Mr. DeMaurice, your question, sir?
I'm going to grab the question I had on the sports show the other night. And it's a twofold question, and it's relating to the holidays. When did you stop, the moment you stopped believing in Santa Claus, and how do you explain that to kids today about this concept of Santa Claus?
Yeah, it is a twofold question. In a sense, I think I stopped about 8 or 9, but before I stopped then, it was easy for me to start doubt it and not believe it because I don't think I really got the things I asked for Christmas. I always got the knockoff. <off, bro.
laughs> Well, what'd you ask for, little Mark?
So you realize if Santa Claus wasn't listening, or he really wasn't trying to get you exactly what you asked for. So that helped me to understand that, and it was just impossible for him to do that. And then I realized, you know, of course, the parents are doing such. I mean, I take this method with my own kids. There was a certain joy about waking up in the morning and believe that someone left you something. And those years that I did believe, the early years I did, was something special and magical about that. I know people make it, sometimes they make it a black, white thing, and I get that to an extent. But that's something for the early stages of my children's life, I didn't want to rob them of that. So I allowed them to experience that. And as they start to come around, I said my son might have been 9, 10. When you start to realize other kids may break it to him and he's going to be out there wondering what the hell is going on, I had the conversation with him. And kind of same with my daughter a little early. You give them the chance to enjoy it some, but you realize that it's going to start to kind of, at some point, somebody's going to say and tell them and explain them. And if that's going to happen, I wanted that to be me or their mother that kind of said it to them. So I explained it to him and explained what was behind it, why it was done as such. And I said for them, it's not your place to tell another kid that he doesn't exist. The same way I'm sharing that with you, allow their parents to share that with them. So I think, you know, seven, I'm going to say eight, nine, anytime after eight, I think, you know, if you can give them to seven or eight, I think at eight you may want to start to kind of really let them understand. But to me, it's almost like, I mean, there's certain things that I enjoyed as a kid that I wanted them to enjoy. Just like Halloween, bro. I know we didn't have Halloween this year. And for the most part, they didn't care. My kids at this point, a stage, they're not big on it. But what was better than going out one night of the year, dressing up, and knocking on somebody's door and coming back home with a big bag of candy you ain't even going to eat, but you just got it anyway? There's certain things that just kind of went, that went with our childhood. And I'm amazed sometimes when people, they enjoyed it, but now you want to rob kids of it. So there's certain things, man, that just kind of go along with childhood. You could disagree with it or not, but I just think there's certain things that I wanted them to experience that I experienced. And I know now when I think back to those moments, the great memories that they were. I remember one Christmas in particular, man, my son was maybe five or six at the time, and some things he wanted, and those things he got. And I remember him, you know, putting together, he had got an ear hockey table, and I'm putting it together, and he's sitting there, and he's looking at me, and he says to me, "You're the best dad ever."
Cool.
And how do you replace that? What do you do? I mean, that right there, for him to just open up and say that and realize he had to take a little time and think about it. Okay, Dad got this and that. And to say that on a Christmas morning when basically I've been up all night and hear that, there ain't nothing better. Your response, Mr. Charles?
Yeah. Anyway, for me it was like probably 9 or 10. And, you know, some people, they had some tough situations with Santa Claus. I love Santa Claus because Santa Claus bought me what I wanted. You know what? I got some great gifts. And then I heard the whole thing people talking about, well, you know, as somebody mentioned to me about a white man. I didn't give a damn who he was. I just thought he was a nice man and he brought me a bunch of stuff. I give a damn who he was. All I know is when I opened up them presents, I was like, oh, my God, Santa Claus, yeah. You know, I love Santa Claus because Santa Claus took care of me. The only thing Santa Claus didn't bring me, and I'm still dealing with that right now, I wanted that damn G.I. Joe with the Kung Fu grip. I'm still looking for it right now, online, looking for one. Man, something about that G.I. Joe with the Kung Fu grip. So in regards to the kids now, I mean, I'm with you, Mark. I mean, you can tell them whatever you want to, but I look at it this way, that life is so short, man, and as I continue on my journeys and things I'm putting together now, that I realize how much of my childhood was shortened, right, by things I had to do at an early age, and my inner child still has suffered over the years because I had to do growing-up stuff quickly. So if I can allow or help a child to enjoy their childhood the way it should be, as kids and really enjoy certain things, I'm all for it, man. That's, to me, what childhood should be all about. You're not supposed to have any worries. You're not supposed to be worrying about it, taking care of your mama's kids all the time. Anyway, yeah, I said that. I'm just saying, sometimes kids should just be children, man, and enjoy life the way it's supposed to be done with no worries and no complications.
Yeah, I couldn't say any better than that, but you're right. Kids should be kids, man. You know, and we see that in our neighborhood all the time. They got, you know, you got your kid taking care of. No, that's your responsibility. You lay down and have sex to have that kid. Why is your kid now playing mommy and daddy? You know, kids need to experience that and have it because you're only a kid once. Once. That's all you are. You don't get a chance to rewind that back and become a kid again. So, no, man, that's dead on. Mr. DeMaurice, your response to your question, sir?
Yeah, I know when I was younger, I had Uncle Andrew and Kurt. They just ruined Christmas for me, man. Told me Santa Claus was in jail and he was messing with little kids.
Wow.
they ruined it for me. So everybody home crying to mom, is this true? I remember one particular incident where my mom had, I wanted the big gym with the Kung Fu studio. And I've been asked for it all year. They used to get the catalogs, and I used to point to my mama, cut out the picture. Here's what I want for Christmas. And I have a cousin named Oliver Jr., who's the same age. And my mother and Oliver Jr.'s mom, Aunt Lucille, used to go shopping together at King's. And, you know, they'd take a long time. And Jr. could put everything he wanted in the cart, and Aunt Lucille would just give it to him. But my mama didn't play that. So I remember helping my mom. We lived out in Brookside. We lived out in Brookside, projects out in the suburbs. And I remember I was helping my mom take stuff from the car to the house. And she opened up the trunk, or I opened up the trunk, and saw the big gym and the Kung Fu set. And I'm like, oh, mama, you got me this. And she's like, no, that's your cousin Junior. And I went off. I went off on my mom. He always getting himself up, getting you always just such and such and such. And she ain't say nothing. Usually, I get a backflip, back slap in the mouth. She ain't say nothing. And then that later that night, you leave cookies and milk for Santa Claus. And I remember the next morning, the big gym was there. And then I picked up the glass of milk, and it was half filled, and the cookies were eaten. And when I picked up the milk, I could smell my father's breath on the milk. And I'm like, okay, Santa Claus doesn't exist. It's them buying it. But the way I kind of did it with my kids is that I told them that the Santa Claus was like a story, like stories that they watch and all that other stuff. And I just couldn't bring myself to kind of, I didn't really wreck their dreams about Santa Claus. I'm like, this is a story. This is what people believe and things of that sort. But I didn't want to give credit because I made a lot of money over Christmases over the years. And I didn't want to give credit to a big fat man coming to the house giving free toys. And the mom was very, supportive and kind of, kind of giving them the fantasy and stuff. But I always kind of refrained from that, didn't tell them that it wasn't. But I'm like, well, this is a story. That people believe that used to happen and things of that sort. And I guess with people's kids today, I don't ruin it. So I'm like, my uncles ruined it for me. But I always try to kind of give fun to it and ask a lot of questions of what they believe and all that stuff. And it's great to kind of live in their world and what they believe Santa to be and what they think Santa is and kind of like problem solve. Like, well, how does he get through the house if he don't have a chimney? And see them kind of problem solve it. And it's kind of funny to me to kind of just have those conversations with kids now about it, but not ruining it, but just having them kind of think. And hopefully as they get older, they'll go, okay, now I get it. I get what he was doing.
Gentlemen, we got like a minute or two before we wrap things up. I'm going to do a quick hit. I know, Mr. Charles, you said that what you're trying to get, but if it wasn't that gift, what gift from your childhood, a toy from your childhood, if you can go back and play right now, what would it be?
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Electric football, man.
Yeah, buddy.
Electric football.
Yeah,
with some magnets, damn it. I didn't never know you needed magnets.
Mr. D. Reese, if you go back, what game or what toy would you want to play right now from your child that was given to you for Christmas?
Your matchback cars? No.
Here we go, bro.
I love the action figures, man. I truly miss the action figures. Like the big, I did have the G.I. Joes with the Kung Fu grip. Big Jim.
The hell with you.
the Marvel comics, the DC comics. I miss those action figures, man. I wish I had those action figures today. I'd probably be stuck in the house playing with them by myself, nobody watching me relive my childhood again.
Y'all too much, man. I got one. The Rock and Sock and Robots. If you can give me that again to play with.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I'm good. You're not
hey,
my
Mark,
ball call.
Hey Mark. Hey
yes,
Mark.
Mm-hmm.
I want to tell you I got a fake version of it right here, baby. Come get it.
Y'all have a good week. We'll catch you up and do it again real soon. It's a Black Man Talk with the D. Reese, Mark Elliott, Mr. Charles. Be safe.